Hello.
That was perfectly in sync. Wow.
Almost. We've done better before.
Have we?
There was one we were both like, hello.
Ooh, maybe we should go with the low hello from now on. Hello.
We'll go up here. You go down there.
We can harmonize.
My name's Kellen Dougherty.
And my name's Leah Nielsen.
And you are listening to Sort of Splained.
This is Sort of Splained. We're going to be splaining up a storm today.
Yeah, Leah's going to explain something to me. I'm saying explain because some of my friends have been like confused about what splain is. They're like, what? And I like have to say it like
fully.
Or I just have to say it like slower because I think I say it fast, like sort of splained, and they're like, what?
I guess it could sound like splayed. We're sort of splayed.
Or I forget what they said it sounded like when I say it really fast. They're like, it sounds like you're saying like, yeah, like sort of splained.
Sort of splained. Yeah, I'm going to explain something, but really just splain it because I'm not going to go crazy. Come on now.
One of these days we might go crazy.
One of these days. If you're just tuning in, nothing is better. The world is still crazy. Everything is still bad.
Everything is on fire.
Yeah, it's wild. So,
metaphorically, but maybe also physically. And mentally, emotionally.
Yes, all of it.
Psychologically.
Draining. Yeah, so I'm going to talk about something that's not topical, bringing it way back for a fun little thing called Prohibition.
Okay.
Ooh, yeah.
Takes me back to the good old days.
Back to the good old days where Gatsby and I were hanging out.
Life was so simple.
Yeah, definitely not something relevant right now as everyone is drinking themselves to a stupor.
Or getting high enough to a stupor. I think these are the two.
Well, you're in the legal marijuana state. I am not in the legal marijuana state, but people are still getting high.
You got the medical marijuana state. Right?
We do, actually. Yeah, that's true.
Oh, yeah, I know that because my 92-year-old grandma has a medical marijuana card.
No way!
Yeah.
Does she use that, I guess?
All the time, apparently.
Ooh, does she get, like, gummies? I feel like that's what grandma's like, the edible gummies.
No, I don't think she can chew well. Maybe that's not true. But no, she likes the oil because it's the strongest.
Whoa!
Yeah. And apparently they just, like, give her whatever she wants.
Yeah, when you're that old.
Because she's like, I don't know, I need it. And they're like, okay, you're 90.
Okay, that sounds right. You're so old, I can't even think of what you would need it for. You look like you need it.
She, like, goes in with, like, well, not anymore, because she can't leave her retirement home.
Right.
But before this, she would go in with, like, her little walker. And they would, like, always know, like, there's Yvonne coming in for her weekly errand.
Yeah, to get her dank kush. There's Yvonne getting her sticky icky. Okay, yeah, so Prohibition. This is not about Prohibition weed, which is still, we're still kind of in that, but the alcohol prohibition of the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So it all started, it actually dates back pre-US, really. There was a pretty big temperance movement in colonial era US, so like before the US was the US. Hmm. So that's like where the origins come from. At that time, there were sort of these social controls that maintained the legality of alcohol until like the 1700s. Basically, they thought, if you're an alcoholic, it's your fault, it's not the alcohol's fault. But slowly that mindset started changing, where it's like, oh, well, we can't control it, you know, we have to put some prohibition on it and stuff. But at the time, there were some social norms that kind of kept the alcohol legality in check. Then, after independence, This is in 1789. 200 farmers in Connecticut formed a temperance movement based on the writings of physician Benjamin Rush. So he was the first guy who labeled drunkenness as a disease, saying, like, alcoholism is a disease, you can't prevent it, it's not your fault kind of deal. So these farmers in Connecticut basically outlawed alcohol in their little community. Then, in 1791, we see the Whiskey Rebellion take place in West Pennsylvania. Isn't that kind of your hood?
That's my old hood, my old stomping ground. I remember learning about that in AP history.
I don't think
I've heard the term Whiskey Rebellion since then, so I don't remember it at all.
We're getting into that AP history knowledge, hell yeah. So it took place in Western Pennsylvania. Basically, there was a government tax placed on whiskey, and people got super upset. But on the other side of things, there were a lot of people that agreed with it, and they thought it was, they called it a sin tax, and it was like they were putting a tax on the sin of liquor, and this tax would hopefully show people how harmful alcohol is and, you know, move towards making it illegal. Mm-hmm. However, the Whiskey Rebellion didn't really work, and then the whiskey tax was repealed in 1800 when Thomas Jefferson came around, and they repealed it. But these are sort of the like beginnings of the temperance movement, and as time went on, more temperance organizations started to pop up, some of them being like whole statewide organizations. And this is where it's kind of like, oh, yay, like, women are involved, but also, like, oh, it's kind of for something lame.
Yeah.
So women started getting in on this idea of temperance. There was sort of a social disparity in drinking. It was, like, drinking was kind of seen as vital for men's health, but it was seen as, like, a real sin and moral corruption for women. And there was this concept and there was this concept of true motherhood that was becoming popular in the middle class in the early U.S. And so it was, these middle class women were refraining from alcohol and basically trying to get their family to refrain from alcohol because they were seen as the moral leaders of the home. And they saw drinking as a threat to purity and motherhood. So they kind of were boring.
But it wasn't like a religious thing?
It was combined, but this is sort of like one of the ideas about it. But this is right when the big like temperance societies start forming. So in 1826, the American Temperance Society is formed, and by 1835, it reaches 1.5 million members. And of those 1.5 million members, women made up 30 to 60% of the chapters. So women had a huge involvement in the American Temperance Society. And they called it the Dry Crusade, and this continued on into the 1840s. And this was, it was led by pietistic religious groups. So, especially the Methodists, they were like the big people into it. And the Methodists were the same sort of people that believed in true motherhood and like basically leading. It was crucial for a Christian life to lead a moral life, whatever moral meant to them, which was like absolute purity and no drinking.
I mean, there's true motherhood and then false motherhood.
I don't know, like
like this is a true mother.
Like, if you're false motherhood, are you just like a mother that drinks a whiskey at night? Like,
yeah,
like, it's just exclusionary and like trying to make it seem like they're better than other mothers.
Yeah. Like kind of how like stay-at-home moms try to make working moms feel worse. Like, I'm a true mother. I love my children so much. I don't work. I just stay home with them all day. And then they're like, well, we're poor. We got to work.
Yeah, like, you still have kids. Or, like, I've heard it's crazy. There's people who are like, yeah, you're not a true mother if you have a C-section. Like, what?
Oh, God.
Isn't that crazy?
Ugh, I hate that.
That's like, I know. It's like, oh, you're not a true mother because you didn't risk your life with a complicated pregnancy. Yeah.
You didn't almost kill yourself and your baby.
Yeah, like, what the fuck?
Or, oh, you're not a true mother if you take an epidermal.
Yeah. Like,
epidural, not epidermal.
I think, yeah.
The skin.
Epidermal would be on top of the skin,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Like, yeah, I want to be so high, like, if I'm giving,
I don't
want to
know what's going on.
Yeah, like, give me all the drugs. I don't care. Like, the baby's gonna pop out and be like, what up? And I'm gonna be like, yo, we're both high, baby.
Yo, what's up, baby?
Let's get some kush in here.
Yeah. Let's get that dank from Yvonne. My 92-year-old dealer.
She comes in with her walker and just a blunt in one hand.
To the hospital. To
there
the
is my great-grandchild.
Yeah, that sounds good. That sounds ideal. That's. Can I tell my birth teacher that's the experience that I want? How can we incorporate this? Yeah, so these pietistic religions... yeah, we're based on the belief of individual piety being crucial to a vigorous Christian life, and they were pretty crazy about morals and stuff. There's this funny lithograph I saw, like, in this thing, and it was made during the time, by Nathaniel Currier, and it illustrates what they called the drunkard's progress in 9 steps, from the first glass to the grave. So they were really crazy about the downfall of the drunkard. But I'm just going to read these steps to you because I think they're hilarious. So, step 1, a glass with a friend. Oh, like, how nice and fun. Mm-hmm. Step 2, a glass to keep the cold out. Brr, gotta keep
warm. Need my hot toddy.
Ooh, give me that hot toddy.
Ooh, snowing outside.
Step 3, a glass too much. Oh no.
Oh, this hot toddy is stronger than I thought. I'm dizzy.
It's pretty hot, actually. Step 4, drunk and riotous.
Hey, you want to go outside and fight?
It's a riot.
Leah, you want to join my fight club?
Yeah, only after these 3 hot toddies. Step 5, this is the summit the summit has been attained. Jolly companions, a confirmed drunkard.
What?
I don't know. It seems nice. It's like you got a lot of companions. You're chilling out.
Yeah, that seems better than wanting to fight.
Right?
Or does that mean, like, sexy? Like, oh, I'm going to try to hit on these women that aren't my wife?
The illustration was all men, like, just chilling around a table.
Oh, homoeroticism, though. I don't know.
Maybe
that that's pretty dangerous.
Maybe they were looking into that.
Hey, and then I'll take off our pants.
Yeah. And then, okay, so this seems like a big jump to me. Step 6, poverty and disease. Like, you go from having a good time with your jolly companions to poverty and disease.
Wow. So. Yeah, that's like, I feel like should have like 20 more steps in between those two.
Quite a few. Okay, step 7, forsaken by friends. So you're... Your companions leave you after the poverty and disease, though.
Well, I mean, if they stay with you through that.
Yeah, they must be good friends.
Yeah.
Jolly companions.
There's only so much people can take.
Yeah. Step 8, desperation and crime, which kind of makes sense if you're right. Impoverished and have no friends.
Yeah.
Okay.
And disease.
Yeah. And then step 9, death by suicide.
Oh.
Which is weird to me because I feel like often alcohol deaths are related to, like, cirrhosis or, like, diseases caused by alcoholism. I wouldn't say the number one is suicide.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong, but it just seems odd.
Or, like, accidental alcohol poisoning. Like, you weren't trying to kill yourself. You just were so drunk you didn't realize you drank another fifth of whiskey.
Right. But the illustration had a guy with a gun to his head.
Oh, so he's
they were like
shooting himself in the head.
Yeah, they were really like going for it. Mm. Yeah, so this was the progression that the typical temperance person saw, or like thought, believed to be true.
Okay.
So we're starting to see this movement kind of gain some success. In 1851, the Maine Law was passed, and this was... The guy who was mayor of Portland, Maine, Neil Dow, was a big temperance activist, and the law was the first statewide prohibition thing we've seen. So it banned the manufacture and sale of liquor. Hmm. However, it was repealed in 1856, but after the Maine law, 12 other states followed suit and adopted total prohibition. So it starts getting some states involved. It's nowhere near like the federal level at this point, but states are starting to do this. Then, boom, the Civil War, 1861 to 1865. The prohibition movement lost a lot of support because I don't think anyone...
I wonder why.
Like, you're definitely going to want to that sip of whiskey when you're on the battlefield. Like, no one's going to really... care.
Yeah. Isn't that also like what they, I mean, I know they were also doing like opioids, but like to like deal with their grief of like losing all their limbs.
Yeah. I think it was just like a lot of like, we're trying to make this as numbed as possible because things are atrocious. So yeah.
And we don't know what anesthetics are yet. So,
or antibiotics. So have fun with your gangrenous foot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so Civil War kind of puts it on hold, but the movement was revived after the Civil War. And this is when the National Prohibition Party is founded in 1869, and the Women's Christian Temperance Union, or WCTU, and they were founded in 1873. So those are two heavy hitters for the Prohibition movement at the time. And so what was kind of cool, the Women's Christian Temperance Union went sort of hand in hand with women's suffrage because it got women talking and publishing in politics before women were. It also gave women a voice to advocate for other causes, not just temperance, such as labor laws and prison reform. So this is when it started... women were starting to be able to like kind of have a say because they were basing it in the family unit, but talking in public, which was like, guys were like, I guess we'll allow it for temperance. But they were a little weird. They did some weird things too. They weren't all just like cool women suffrage ladies. They targeted children pretty heavily. As the new generation of that could like bring about total prohibition. And they had these things called white ribbon ceremonies where they would take actual babies and they would have like an adult sponsor for the babies.
I already don't like where this is going.
Yeah. And they would basically, the adult sponsor would like sign a thing and dedicate this baby's life to an alcohol-free life. And they would tie this white ribbon around the baby's wrist. So it was just, like, weird. And the white ribbon was sort of their symbol, too. So they did some weird stuff that wasn't totally chill, either.
Is okay. That just like, oh, I promise that this baby is going to live in a house with two parents that don't drink alcohol, or that this baby will never drink alcohol when it grows up?
The baby. They were like, this baby will live an alcohol-free life, I promise.
Okay. It's a lot of pressure to put on a baby.
I think it was like a form of baptism that they were like working with, where they're like, this baby's gonna be pure from alcohol with this white ribbon.
I mean, it's pretty good marketing ploy to be like, look at this little baby. Can you imagine in 20 years if this baby's a drunk?
Yeah,
and people will be like, oh no.
Disease and impoverished.
In a ditch with a gun to his head.
Right? Exactly. So that was the kind of the thing that they were doing. Okay, so now we get 1881. Kansas becomes a dry state. It outlaws alcoholic beverages in its constitution. And this is when we get to see motherfucking Carrie Nation. Okay? Carrie Nation. I had not heard of this person, but it's wild.
Who that is.
She is an extreme temperance activist. Female. She's a lady. And she would perform vigilante hatchetations. She called them hatchetations around Kansas to uphold the prohibition law. So basically, they had put this, like, prohibition into the Constitution, but they didn't have, like, a body that was enforcing it. So there were still sort of bars happening, but Carrie Nation did not like that. She would enter a bar singing and praying, and she would smash bar fixtures and bottles of alcohol with a hatchet.
What?
Yeah. So, pretty crazy. Her hatchet had the...
How did she get a... How did people let her do that?
Because she would, like, come in as, like, a woman, like, just thinking, like, oh, she's just a... Because if you see a picture of her, she just looks like a kind of middle-aged woman.
Yeah.
And so she, and then I think she would, like, start singing and praying and doing crazy things, and then...
People are like, look at this kooky lady.
Yeah, they'd be like, she's wild. And but then she would bring out this hatchet that had Death of Rum engraved on the handle, and she would smash their shit. She would smash all their alcohol.
Wow.
Yeah. She was arrested over 30 times and jailed and fined a bunch. And she was pretty wild. She was became like nationally known. She became super famous. And there was this slogan that a lot of saloons would have on them that said, "All nations are welcome except Carrie." Which I think is very inviting, you know, and like pretty silly.
Yeah, I mean, it's before they were getting all xenophobic and
right.
I mean,
right.
It was definitely very racist, but it was yeah. Like, yeah, come in, all the immigrants, it's fine, just not that crazy lady.
Not that one woman with a hatchet.
The like original Karen.
Yeah, she absolutely.
I'll take this into my own hands.
Yeah,
911.
The purity of my family matters. Death of Rome.
There are men drinking at a bar 2 miles away from me. Okay, but
I'm calling the police.
What's the emergency? They're drinking. Okay, but are they hurting you? No, but come quick.
That was Carrie Nation. So basically, she became very famous. She used her fame to then speak and perform in Great Britain, but this was getting sort of towards the late of her life, but at a performance in Music Hall in 1909, a person struck her with an egg, and she got super pissed, and she ripped up her contract, and returned to the U.S.
Okay.
So,
Seems like a Karen thing to do as well.
Yeah, it was a Karen thing to do. She then made money by selling photos of herself and commemorative hatchets around the U.S.
So she just starts her own Etsy shop.
She sells out. Late in life, she moved to Eureka Springs, Arkansas, and then she collapsed during a speech there saying, "I have done what I could." And then she was taken into a hospital in 1911 and died.
Mm.
She never saw national prohibition. So
wow.
That's the death of a Karen. That's what happens to a Karen. She never sees what she wants.
Her dreams never came to fruition.
Exactly. Okay, but still, the temperance movement is getting chugging along. Other states begin to enact prohibition legislation. And individual counties within states start to ban alcohol completely. Also, post-Civil War industrialization gave rise to a lot of saloons for workmen. They would often offer free lunch that included a heavily salted meat or food that encouraged thirst and drinking. So these saloons were sort of seen as like these like gross places that men would get drunk midday. Mm-hmm. So this is when we start to enter the progressive era, which is 1890 to 1920. And this is the progression of prohibition kind of. And I think also other things, but I'm using it in a prohibition way. So there was a strong anti-saloon movement, and it was literally called the Anti-Saloon League, and they became the new popular prohibition group. The WCTU, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, sort of moved more towards women's suffrage and like less towards prohibition legislation. So now we start to see in national politics debates of prohibition. And there were basically two ethno-religious political forces at hand. So there were the Dries and there were the Wets, which makes it sound like a West Side Story type club gang thing? Musical? Club gang musical?
Just both doing pirouettes on either side. Exactly. Like an alleyway.
Yeah, precisely.
Except if one group is like completely drunk and the other group is completely sober.
It'd be weird.
Yeah, dance wise, it's not good if you're trying to dance with someone and you're sober and they're very drunk.
Yeah.
Or vice versa. I've been on either side, so.
Yeah. I don't know who would dance better. Would it be the loose drunk people or the uptight, very precise?
I mean, it depends what kind of dancing you're trying to go for.
It's true.
You know, are you crumping or are you doing ballet?
I just want to see, like, these people, the Dries and the Wets, crump dancing against each other in political forums in the 1800s.
Well, that would be when their, like, newsy culture is happening, right? That's a musical.
Yeah, it would be.
I don't know anything about musicals, but I know that's a musical.
The Newsy musical?
Yeah, Newsies.
That like sounds right, I guess.
Bunch of boys in news hats, newsboy hats, and they dance. And they say, get ya, read it, all about it, here first.
Get your nose here for a penny. A half penny. Yeah, that was basically the time. You're right. So we got these two clubs. We got the Dries, obviously the prohibition supporters, and these were those pietistic religious people. So we got Methodists, Northern and Southern Baptists, New School Presbyterians, Quakers, Scandinavian Lutherans, and sort of a sprinkle of the Latter-day Saints.
Wow.
Yeah.
So they really just banded all the religions together.
Yeah, well, they were
all together. Oh, we all don't like fun? Perfect.
Well, it was the other way around. It was all these religions already didn't like fun, and they were like, oh, you don't like fun too? And then they all banded together.
They were like, are you really repressed as well? Oh, cool. That's something we have in common.
Yeah.
How many crucifixes do you have in your house? Do you need more? Because I have some.
I have some extras. Basically, they identified saloons as politically corrupt dens of sin. Okay, so that's one part of the Dries people. We also got the tea merchants and soda manufacturers supporting prohibition because they believed it would up the sales of their drinks. Which kind of makes sense. I kind of get their thing. Then we also got some African-American labor activists in New York City, and they thought prohibition would benefit workers, especially Black workers in New York City. Don't totally know why, but they believe that.
that banning alcohol would help Black workers?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't know.
Would it be because when white men are belligerently drunk, they're more racist?
Maybe.
And commit more hate crimes?
I could see that being a
thing. I could see that being a thing.
And also, but yeah, it was like the workmen went to these saloons midday, like during lunch, so they would just be drunk there.
Yeah.
Okay, so then we got the other side of stuff. The Wets, they are anti-prohibitionists. And so this is the liturgical Protestants. I feel like I should maybe, like, at some point, start explaining different religions, because I have no idea.
That's the first time I've ever heard that word before.
Liturgical.
I have no idea what that means.
I think it's, like, they go off of the literature. Liturgy. I don't know. But this is the Episcopalians, the German Lutherans, and the Roman Catholics. And they were anti-prohibition, and they denounced the idea that the government should define morality. I think basically because they wanted to define morality like the Roman Catholics do.
Yeah, so they were like, no, no, you don't get to make the rules.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to make the rules.
We do that. That's
wink,
us.
Wink. That comes later.
That's us. Okay, so those are two sides. At this time, we also get an influx of immigrants into the urban centers across the U.S., and prohibitionists attributed crime and moral corruption of the cities to the immigrants, of course, and there were, like, saloons that immigrant communities would gather in, and those would be frequently visited by politicians trying to gain immigrant votes. By kind of, they would promise them favors like job offers, legal assistance, and food baskets. And so this is how the prohibitionists were like, saloons are the origins of political corruption and crime and all this stuff because it's where the immigrants are.
Yeah.
You know? So.
Yeah, that's like, I don't know if you've ever watched Boardwalk Empire.
I haven't. I heard it's pretty good. And I like Steve Buscemi.
Yeah, I've only seen like the first few episodes because it was just like it was a lot to handle, and I was like, this is a whole, it's the whole thing. There's like 10 seasons, maybe not 10 seasons. There's a lot of seasons. I was like, this is too much, but like the whole thing is like Steve Buscemi is just like going to like different women's groups and all these places and being like, yes, the corrupt politicians are there. It's evil. We have to be against, you know, alcohol. But then he's like, no, no, because then I get to make all the money because I'm selling the alcohol.
Because he was a bootlegger.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
But yeah, they definitely had a lot of issues with the Irish. They were like, get these Irish out of here. What's wrong with them? They drink like 12 beers a night.
That was a huge thing. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And there were also some economists that were for prohibition because they thought that productivity in like with workers would increase, which is, I don't think that's totally unreasonable.
I mean, it's not always great if you get really drunk on your lunch break, I guess.
I know, yeah. Happened. They had there was this well-known term called Blue Mondays, and it was basically referring to all the workers being hungover on Mondays because they drank so much over the weekend. And yeah, so this guy, Irving Fisher, he was an economist at Yale, and he made up that term, Blue Mondays. And his research has actually been discredited that, like, it would increase productivity because his experiments didn't have any controls. But people still use his research to, like, they still cite it for arguments for modern prohibitions like marijuana prohibition, which is, like, dumb. Okay, so now we get to when it starts getting real, the 18th Amendment. So in the election of 1916, neither Woodrow Wilson nor the Republican candidate Charles Evan Hughes brought up prohibition at all because it was like so contested that they didn't want to lose votes on either side of the issue. So they just like didn't talk about it. But Woodrow Wilson wins. And in well, then we get into the next thing. In 1917, the US enters World War I. but because of this, German Americans who were strong leaders in the anti-prohibition movement were sidelined and ignored because the Germans were seen as bad. So they were like, German Americans, like, we're not going to listen to your anti-prohibition stuff because we're fighting against you. And then there was also an argument that made that prohibition would free up resources like grain that could be used in the war effort. So basically World War One sort of aided prohibition along.
Okay. Yeah,
which was interesting. The amendment to prohibit alcoholic beverages nationwide was introduced and passed by both houses in December of 1917. World War One ended, and then by January 1919, the amendment was ratified by 36 of the 48 states. We were at 48 states at the time. So basically, January 17th of 1920 is when prohibition starts being real, because that's when they passed the Volstead Act, like Congress passed that, and that allowed a body of government to enforce the 18th Amendment. So we have the 18th Amendment saying, like, no alcohol, no liquor can be sold or manufactured or transported or imported. And then we have the Volstead Act saying that the government can, like, arrest people for that. So we have now 1,520 federal prohibition agents that are tasked with enforcing this law nationwide. So
how many?
Like 1,500. Not a lot.
Nationwide.
But nationwide, yeah. So that's the federal, like, unit is that many agents, yeah. And that'll
like
come up later.
One in every town.
Kind of, yeah, that'll come up later. Yeah. What I thought was pretty interesting is that the manufacture, importation, sale, and transport of alcohol is illegal, but the consumption of alcohol was not. So if you had it, right, you could drink it.
Okay.
And, yeah, so under the Volstead Act, you could also have up to 200 gallons of wine and cider per year. Well, you could make that in your home. Up to 200 gallons per year.
That's a lot of gallons.
That's a lot of gallons.
I mean, I guess it depends how big your family is.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, a year is 365 days, so then that's like...
That's almost,
that's still...
almost a gallon a day. Yeah. Like 3/4 of a gallon a day. But yeah, so they that's wine and cider, but not beer. You couldn't make beer.
Why?
I don't know. Because also, like, wine and cider are more alcoholic.
Yeah.
I really don't know.
I'm also confused because isn't, like... Don't you always, I mean, I also don't know anything about religion because I was raised non-religious, but like,
yeah,
don't you usually drink wine in church because that's the blood of Christ?
Yes, that was allowed.
So
they were allowed, like religious people, religious organizations were allowed to have that. Yeah. That was legal. But you couldn't manufacture alcohol unless it was 200 gallons of wine or cider per year in your own home.
Because that does make sense, because sometimes I feel like, yeah, like, people don't realize how easy it is to make your own alcohol.
Yeah, people
like,
do
if
it.
If people in prison can make prison wine in their toilets, then, like, anybody can make alcohol themselves.
Yeah, definitely. And that's what I'm about to get in next. One little tidbit. Also, people stockpiled like crazy all the wine and liquor in 1919, because there was that little period of time where they like ratified the 18th Amendment, and then there was a couple months before they were able to enforce it.
Yeah.
So like people just went crazy and like bought up everything they possibly could. Yeah. Oh. So what was interesting was that prohibition created this huge class divide because the rich were able to stockpile and make their own supply of alcohol, but the employees and poor people couldn't. So it was like a huge divide in who could drink. And like, also obviously the poor people were the people being busted for this mm-hmm. stuff. So we get to where it gets exciting. We get to bootlegging. So basically bootlegging pretty much immediately began once the Volstead Act was put into place. Within the first year of prohibition, 29,114 Volstead Act violations were recorded where bootlegged alcohol was confiscated and destroyed or poured out. So it was everywhere. It was like really widespread. Also, grape juice was not illegal, even though within, this is how easy it is. Within 60 days, grape juice can ferment and make wine that has a 12% alcohol content. So
within
that was pretty.
60 days?
60 days, yeah.
And how apparently, much alcohol content?
12%.
What?
Yeah.
That's a lot.
You just have to keep your Welch's grape juice out of the fridge for 60
like
days.
Like in a barrel in my cellar.
I think in your plastic bottle it would still work. It wouldn't be tasty.
Well, I'm sure like the juice of today has like way too many other additives in it.
You're right, like preservatives and stuff.
But if back then it was probably just like straight up just like juice.
Switch rates, yeah. Yeah. It was. Okay, so this is a really interesting thing that the government does. So to prevent the use of industrial ethyl alcohol in bootlegging, because they needed to still have this ethyl alcohol for other industrial stuff, the government poisoned all of the supplies of industrial alcohol. So they denatured the alcohol, making it poisonous. In response, bootleggers hired their own chemists to renature the alcohol. These are like two chemical things. And then they would use it for fermenting and it would be drinkable. So the re-rebuttal from the government was that they just added more deadly poisons, one of which is methyl alcohol, to industrial alcohol supplies. So they were poisoning that stuff up.
They're like murdering people.
Oh yeah.
Like, so people don't know they're doing that.
They do. Sure. They did know, but it was like.
But like, how many people knew?
Probably not a ton. You know, like communication isn't that great at the time.
Yeah, and if you're like really hard up, you're not paying attention to what is going in anything. You're also just like, I gotta drink this.
Yeah. Also, if you're buying from a bootlegger, you don't know that they're using governmental ethyl alcohol, like industrial ethyl alcohol, to make their bootleg. You know, you're just trying to get some booze.
So
in New York City, over 10,000 deaths were attributed to poisoning by denatured bootleg alcohol. So it was huge.
Okay. Cool.
And this is during prohibition. Cool. Yeah, and so in the same way that you were saying, Charles Norris, the New York City medical examiner at the time of prohibition, said the government was essentially committing murder because they knew the poisoning was not deterring alcohol consumption, but they continued to poison it anyway. Which is wild. Pretty wild. The government's crazy.
That would be like during like the crack epidemic, they were like, well, let's just put like some rat poison in it, and then people won't do it anymore. That'll
fix
it. Oh, yeah. Now everyone's dead.
Great. It's like, yeah, that's pretty crazy. I feel like that might have almost been a thing. That they tried to make crack poisonous, like more poisonous.
Than it already is.
Yeah, I don't know. So bootlegging's widespread. It was actually almost encouraged in certain ways. A lot of stores sold grape juice, and on the grape juice there would be labels defining the steps to prevent it from fermenting, but it was basically giving you instructions on how to ferment your grape juice.
Like, hey, you want to make sure this doesn't turn into alcohol because that's illegal, right?
Right.
Make sure you don't follow these 9 steps.
Yeah, these very explicit 9 steps. Yeah, so it's pretty crazy.
Except for the one of, like, turning into an alcoholic. This one's like slowly people are becoming more fun.
Yeah.
Like step one, you just have juice. Step two, you feel a little dancey. Step three,
yeah,
you start flirting.
Definitely.
Those are the only steps I can think of.
Those are the only steps.
I don't know what else happens when you're drunk.
I don't know.
You order cheesy fries.
Yeah. Then you get McDonald's.
You wake up with a Pop-Tart in your bed.
The Nature Valley bar is so crunchy in your sheets. Yeah. Okay, so bootlegged hard liquor was called bathtub gin in the north, and it was called moonshine in the south. As we know, moonshine's like still pretty big. Mm-hmm. And manufacturers of these things were pursued by agents, federal agents called the revenuers. And in response to this, moonshiners would soup up their cars, making them super fast to outrun the police. And these were called shine runners. So that was just like a fun fact. I thought it was cool. So another way that illegal liquor was procured was smuggling. Neighboring countries like Canada, Mexico, and the Bahamas had a huge influx of their alcohol sales, and also just like tourists coming and drinking at their bars. A lot of smuggling was done along the Detroit River that comes from Canada, like the mouth, or like it flows from Canada, and it was like really hard to enforce. So that was a huge thing that a lot of people did, alcohol running. Another one that I didn't know about was sort of this form of medical malpractice. Basically, liquor was legal for doctors to prescribe. It was that time.
Okay.
Yeah. So doctors were able to prescribe alcohol to their patients, and physicians earned about $40 million between 1921 and 1930 on whiskey prescriptions alone. So they were doling them out.
Wow, it's like, what is it? Oh, I don't know, like today.
Like today with
like, oh, other crisis. We make more money if we give prescriptions to people that don't really need them.
Right.
Huh.
Right.
I don't know how that happens.
And these doctors may have even, say, been working with the bootleggers or the people manufacturing the whiskey and getting paid for it to give out more whiskey prescriptions.
Yeah.
Because
wasn't it like you sometimes would even give it to like babies to like get them to sleep?
I heard that was a thing. Put like it in their bottles. Put it like around their lips and they would go to bed.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know they would do that with like heroin, or maybe not heroin, opium. Like the poppy.
Oh, like, opium.
Opium, yeah. The precursor. But yeah, just like sprinkle opium in the bottle.
On my baby real
quick. With some whiskey, and the babies love it. They like go crazy for it.
They get real sleepy, and we don't have to deal with it anymore. That was a thing. 11 million prescriptions were written each year throughout the 1920s, and there was one doctor that reportedly wrote 475 whiskey prescriptions in one day. So he was having a good time, probably wrote himself a couple of those whiskey prescriptions.
He had to have been rolling in it.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I'm sure that's so many, how many, like, that's crazy. Like, how many prescriptions an hour do you just have, like, you walk into the doctor's room and there's, like, 20 men in there and you're just like, okay, everybody has aches and pains? Perfect.
Good. Whiskey.
Here's a bottle of wine. Get out of here.
And it seems almost hard. Like, these are physically written prescriptions because it's the 1920s. Like, to write 475 prescriptions in a day. That's a long work day. Like, you're going crazy there, dude.
Yeah.
So we also had medicinal wine that had a 22% alcohol content. This was sold at drugstores. But they added this medicinal taste to make it sort of acceptable, but it still was, like, fucking crazy.
Is it just, like, cough syrup?
Yeah. But, I mean, I think, you know, like, if you chug cough syrup now, it's still a drug, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you'll get, I mean, isn't that lean?
Yeah, that's what lean is, yeah.
Cough syrup and, like, Kool-Aid or something?
I think it's lean and grape soda, or, like, some sort of fruit soda.
Okay.
Right?
I don't know.
I don't know. Lean was not one
of
the
apparently don't know a lot about.
That was not in my repertoire. Yeah, so also prescriptions, since they were all written, they were easily faked and counterfeited. And, ooh, this is kind of cool. Historians believe that Charles R. Walgreen of Walgreens expanded from 20 stores to 525 stores in the 1920s because of alcohol prescriptions. So Walgreens is the way it is because that dude was doling out whiskey prescriptions during Prohibition.
Like, you're welcome.
Yeah, you're welcome, Walgreens.
Now, there's a Walgreens on every block in New York City, so don't say I didn't do anything for you.
Yeah. And basically, bootlegging and illegal alcohol was this huge open secret that, you know, like, it was talked about in Gatsby. Like, people knew. People knew about it. However, the majority of the U.S. did obey Prohibition, because it was, like, kind of tough not to. I feel like mostly it was these, like, urban city centers that were able to get this bootlegged alcohol.
Yeah. Especially if you're by a coast.
Yeah, yeah. And there wasn't really a centralized authority that was enforcing the law. They had all those agents, but they weren't really organized. There were also, like, these clergymen that would make vigilante groups that sometimes assisted the government in, like sort of pulling Carrie Nation's deal, where they would, like, run into speakeasies and, like, bust them.
Ah!
Yeah.
They're just all carrying tomahawks.
Yeah. Like, yeah, death to rum souvenir hatchets from Carrie Nation.
Oh, hatchets, right.
Yeah.
Tomahawks would be a little racist, so.
Yeah, but I don't think that was really an issue at the time. Like, I don't think anyone was like, wow, your tomahawk is a little much.
Are you saying the owner of the Washington Redskins might not have been as cool as he seemed?
What are you saying? Yeah, so overall, for Prohibition, it was unfeasible, given the size of the U.S., the difference in terrain, and the, like, lack of centralized enforcement agency. Prohibition was sort of unfeasible. Also, the number of waterways and smuggling points along the borders of the U.S. couldn't be enforced, really. The U.S. is huge. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of the overall take of it, but I'm just going to talk about two cool groups I learned about that were on the enforcement side of Prohibition. So these are two, like, heavy hitters for the government that enforced Prohibition. So we got the Untouchables, and these were a group of special agents run by Elliot Ness, from 1930 to 1932, and they were tasked with taking down Al Capone and his ties to Chicago bootlegging gangs. So this is when we get into the cool movie stuff. So Elliot Ness, was ordered to raid illegal breweries and distilleries, and this was to deprive Capone of a lot of income that he needed to bribe policemen to protect him. They were called the Untouchables because they were known for turning down significant bribes from Chicago gangs, and they were thought to be incorruptible. Hmm. They began raiding Capone's breweries in March 1931, and these raids were said to have a huge financial impact on Capone of about $2 million at the time. So they really helped with bringing down Capone. It was said that this financial harm basically allowed time for the intelligence unit to build their case of tax evasion, which Capone was being held for at the time and ultimately convicted of. So they were sort of like on the back burner that people don't really hear about, but they cut off Capone's supply, so he was able to be arrested and brought down. Hmm. Pretty cool.
Okay.
The other two dudes, these two dudes worked in New York City, Izzy Einstein and Mo Smith, and they were two federal agents that achieved the most arrests and convictions during Prohibition in New York City.
They were guys named Izzy and Mo in New York in this time period seems way too spot on.
Right,
like, you know they're wearing suspenders.
Oh, yeah. And get ready for this. They were known for their use of disguises to, like, get into illegal speakeasies. And they were also known for their successful controlled explosions of speakeasies.
Oh.
Yeah. So they would blow shit up. They were said to be rather rotund, and this would throw off bootleggers and like speakeasy people because they didn't suspect them of being agents at all. And they were
because
just
they were so rotund.
Because they were so rotund. At the time, everyone's like, no agent could be rotund.
Yeah, they're like, oh, well, if we run, they can't catch us. They're too rotund.
It's just Izzy and Mo, you know, like our fun, rotund bootleggers, like, they're coming in here, they're not agents, they're fine.
And they're like, you're right, I won't chase you, but I don't have to. And then he, like, pulls some lever and just dynamite falls out.
Yes. It does feel, like, very vaudeville 1920s crazy. Yeah, so Izzy Einstein developed the Einstein theory of rum snooping, where he used a combo of disguise and not being armed, he like wouldn't bring a gun, that led to many arrests. And it is said that he often told bouncers he was a federal agent, and the bouncers would just like think he was joking and laugh at him and like let him into the speakeasy. He said one time he took bets at a joint that he was an agent, the agent in the picture on the wall. They had a picture of him up on the wall. And then when the people paid him being like, no, you're not him, he arrested them. Huh. So pretty funny, okay. Pretty crazy. They did like a million disguises. Like they said they were like fishmongers and I don't know, just like all this crazy 1920s jobs they would pretend to be and dress up, and it just sounds kind of funny. But ultimately, they had a crazy 95% conviction rate with 4,932 arrests, and they confiscated 5 million gallons of liquor worth, at the time, an estimated $15 million. So they were crazy successful, Izzy and Mo.
And they just dump that into the water.
Yeah, they would, like, dump it into the sewers, like, publicly, or explode it. Yeah.
Ugh. It's funny, because then, like, how many years until the Great Depression? And they're like, oh, we could have used $15 million, I guess.
Yeah, like, that would have been real nice. Yeah. Okay, so now we're getting to when it's winding down. People are starting to not like this so much. So favor for repeal of the 18th Amendment started in the 1930s. They were seeing that prohibition wasn't able to be enforced, and it didn't really have the intended effect that they were thinking with that, like, moral high ground, yeah. Everything's gonna be better, like... Yeah, that did not work out. So John D. Rockefeller, who was a lifelong non-drinker, who contributed, it historians say, anywhere from 350,000 to 700,000 to the Anti-Saloon League, admitted that prohibition had not worked, and he now supported repeal. So he was like a big person who, like a public figure that people were like, oh shit, like maybe, yeah, maybe prohibition isn't working so well. Also, this is kind of cool. This dude named George Cassaday, also known as the man in the green hat. He apparently wore a green hat all the time. There's a picture of him near his green hat, yet it is in black and white only. And I didn't see a colorized version, which was like pretty annoying. He was a bootlegger who worked throughout the entirety of Prohibition. And in 1930, he spoke in front of Congress being like, yeah, I ran this very successful bootlegging business all throughout Prohibition. And I know that 80% of Congress drank and like isn't upholding Prohibition. And basically it's just like not working.
Ah.
So, pretty cool. Pretty like badass and a real kind of gangster move, you know?
Yeah. Like, hey, the whole Senate is blacked out right now. So your whole like, moral high ground is not working.
This is not working.
The president, who was it still? Wilson. He blacked out last night on the lawn.
Yeah. Like, I saw Wilson smooching that harlot in the street. I know what happened. Yeah. So, also, there was an argument made that prohibition, instead of stopping crime, like it was supposed to, actually made well-armed, well-organized crime syndicates. Which is debating. Yeah, I'll kind of talk about that a little later. But it is,
hey, you know, Al Capone.
That's sort of what we see in the movies, where it's like we get those like Tommy gun wielding mobs that weren't really seen before that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
and it made like crime like classy, as long as you were like a white man. But like if you like wear a nice suit, you can rob a bank. Broad daylight.
Yeah, but it was just like business. Like you were just conducting business, and it was
for the family.
For the family. You've just been trying to watch The Sopranos too much,
Tony. You don't understand. My Italian American accent.
I wasn't good.
You're telling me.
Oh God. All right, so we're winding down. We get to the 1932 election. And so the Democrats in the North, where a lot of urban cities were around, and everyone was mostly wet, they supported, obviously, the Democratic candidate, Franklin D. Roosevelt. And he ran on a platform of prohibition repeal. So he was like, yeah, I'm gonna repeal prohibition. Like, this is big. Whereas the previous election where they did the 18th Amendment, like no one talked about it. This was like very much, we want to repeal it. There were also some big organizations that supported the repeal. We got the DuPont brothers, who were still, you know, that's still a thing, DuPont, the company. Mm-hmm. So they were these super well-known rich chemical industrialists, and they led the Association Against the Prohibition Amendment, or AAPA. And then we got it's either Sabin or Sabine, not totally sure. She founded the Women's Organization for National Prohibition Reform. And that was pretty cool. Basically, the 19th Amendment, which is the amendment for women's suffrage and being like letting women vote, had passed already. And so that allowed for this women's movement, more so than the women's temperance movement, to have more like political power for what they were doing. So they were, you know, allowed to vote and allowed to vote and do a lot of things. Sabine stated that the destructiveness of alcohol was now embodied in prohibition itself, and that the Women's Organization for National Prohibition Reform, they basically said that a trend toward moderation and restraint in the use of intoxicating beverages was reversed by prohibition, which is, like, fair. I could see that they you know, they were making a good point with that a little bit.
Yeah.
So the first step towards this stuff was that the Cullen-Harrison Act was signed by Roosevelt in 1933. And this allowed the sale of 3.2% alcohol, beer, and wine. And so everyone was like, what? Like, that's way too low.
That's like a Coors Light.
Yeah, it's really low. Like, I think it's lower than a Coors Light. Aren't they only like 5% or something?
Yeah, I'm just trying to dig at Coors Light.
Yeah, I think it's like an O'Doul. But... like, that's like a non-alcoholic beverage at that point.
That's like grape juice that's only been in your cellar for like 20 days.
Yeah, not the full 60. Seriously. Okay, so then finally we get on December 5th, 1933, the 25th Amendment is passed and ratified, and this repeals the 18th Amendment, which to this day remains the only amendment that repeals another amendment. It was very weird. It wasn't like they repealed the 18th Amendment. They made the 25th Amendment, which is like, yeah, just forget that 18th one. Don't look at it.
Yeah.
It's really weird.
Like, that would be like, really random. Unfortunate if somebody just like stopped after like the 19th Amendment and were like, this is all the information we need. And they were like, no, like please get to 25. Like we didn't have a pencil or an eraser, so you've gotta keep reading.
Yeah, like that is that would be bad.
It's so funny too, because that's why people are like, no, it's in our constitution. We all have a right to own our firearms. And it's like, okay, you know what else is in there? Like a bunch of nonsense.
Yeah, like total like, nonsense.
Yeah. Like,
the whole point is we're supposed to keep changing it. I don't get it.
It's called an amendment because you amend things. It was also written by traitors. So guess what?
For real. Things gotta change. I know. It's crazy. It's wild. I'm not super happy with the U.S. right now. It was actually really funny. So we had this social distance barbecue this weekend for the 4th, and the host of the party bought this Captain America pinata, and because it was fun. But they were like, it's not political. We're not saying like we hate America or anything. But like throughout the process of pinataing, the rope like fell off, so they had to retie the rope like around Captain America's neck.
No,
so it was like basically
lynched Captain America
around Captain America, and everyone was like, "It's not political. It's not political." And then one of the pinata ears, or the person swinging, like didn't realize it had fallen and like stomped on his neck. So it was just like the most brutal pinata-ing of Captain America, and it was like just kind of funny. Wow. You're like it's not political, but it looked real bad.
Meanwhile, Karen is like in the bushes being like,
yeah, she's dialing 911. These people hate America.
Some communists next door, I think you need to arrest them immediately.
They are
yeah, they have a pinata. You better hurry.
Seriously. But luckily, no cops were called and I got Skittles, so. Okay, so we have amended prohibition. We're back to where we are today, almost. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about the like ultimate effects that were had by prohibition.
Okay.
Some of which we still see today. So the good effects, overall alcohol consumption did decrease by an estimated 30-50%. And that with that came along a lot of decrease in alcohol-related health concerns. Okay. So just some statistics on that. Admissions to state mental hospitals for alcoholic psychosis went from 10.1 per 100,000 people in 1919 to 4.7 per 100,000 people in 1928. So that's like a half decrease, basically, 50% decrease. cirrhosis deaths, which is the, like, decay of the liver, basically, among men, went from 29.5 per 100,000 in 1911 to 10.7 in 1929. And that was sort of the same thing, like almost 50% decrease. But that number actually promptly went right back up to the 29.5 after the repeal. So prohibition was helping that stuff. This is kind of a cool side effect of prohibition that I didn't exactly think about. Speakeasies had a huge cultural influence. The death of saloons basically brought about the death of the macho connotation associated with drinking. So speakeasies were semi-public places where women could drink, finally. And it was, like, acceptable. And after repeal, women were now more socially accepted in bars, which is pretty cool. Women also made their way into bootlegging in the bootlegging industry and were making a lot of money. And they were able to do this without easily being suspected. So a lot of women, like, became bootleggers and were very successful with that. Also, the music in speakeasies gave rise to the dispersal of jazz across the U.S. So that was, like, speakeasies had, the cool jazz ambiance. Mm-hmm. And then I will just say that this is just a first step, and it still wasn't great, but this led to a minimal integration of Black musicians into white-owned clubs. So It was a good first step. Obviously not great, but
still working on that one.
Still working, still talking away. Also, this is a kind of good, kind of bad effect that prohibition had. It led to a rise in hard liquors and hard liquor manufacturing in the U.S. due to the high alcohol content and bootlegging ability, which is still culturally relevant. There's still a huge amount of U.S.-based liquor companies, you know, and actually a lot of these bootleggers went legitimate, like, after the repeal, because they had the supplies and they had, like, the ability to do that. However, there were some bad things that happened from the prohibition. Child neglect and violence against children actually increased during prohibition, which completely discredited the claim from the Women's Christian Temperance Union, that like, getting alcohol away would improve family health and morality. So that definitely didn't happen. I guess mainly because these abusive dudes were just home more and not at the bar.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, we're still beating up their kids.
Well, what I was going to say, too, is when I learned about prohibition in AP history, it was always, like, I mean, how I was taught history in general, which I think is what we're realizing for a lot of people in this country, is not great, and we don't get the full story. But I remember, like, being taught, like, yeah, so, like, prohibition was important because men kept beating their wives, so women wanted it to stop. So if you take the alcohol away, it would stop. And I was like, but shouldn't we just teach men not to beat women? And they were like, no, because alcohol was the reason. And I was like, okay, like, I'm like 16, but I'm still like, I don't think that's right.
Yeah. That was definitely the thought at the time. But it's definitely been proven that was like, not the case.
Let's just put the blame on something else other than men being accountable for their actions.
Yeah. Seriously.
And the same thing with, like, saloon culture. It was like, saloons are evil because that's where sex workers are. And it was like, okay, but, like, the men are the ones, like, paying for sex.
For the sex workers, they're like,
yes, but we have to take the alcohol away because the sex workers are evil.
They need to be true mothers. Yeah, but definitely they were not looked at correctly. All right, so another bad effect of the prohibition, the economic cost of the prohibition was pretty bad, but this was according to the AAPA and the WONPR. Those were the two, like, big anti-prohibition organizations. But still, it seems like a pretty legitimate claim. They estimated that there was a loss of $861 million in federal tax revenue from the untaxed liquor that was made during Prohibition, and there was approximately $40 million spent annually on Prohibition enforcement. So, federally, big poo-poo.
No, that's not great.
Yeah, big money doo-doo. Yeah, so... Also, big thing that was definitely clear, Prohibition had a disproportionately adverse effect on Black people, poor immigrants, and even poor white people. So basically there was a huge increase in discrimination and everything that came with that. Also, this was kind of interesting, which I didn't even think about, wine historians say that Prohibition destroyed a fledgling wine industry in the U.S. that was just starting to come around in the 1910s. Because it's like, you know, our wine industry is like newish, California-based, you know, maybe starting in like, I don't know, the 60s or something. Yeah, so it's like the U.S. could have had a much more historically significant wine influence, but Prohibition kind of stopped that and went for the hard liquor, the Kentucky whiskey.
Because why isn't there any like wineries in like the South?
There aren't many. There is actually a winery around here in Maryland called Bordy Wines, but it's, you know, it's rare. It's like not often a thing.
Yeah, because there's, like, so many countries where it's, like, you're in wine country now, and it's just, like, rolling hills full of wineries.
I mean, we have that in Napa. Napa Valley is, like, that. I've driven there. But, like,
that's
still.
That's, like, the only one.
Yeah, it is.
California.
It is. I mean, there's other wineries, obviously, but it's not pervasive like it is in other countries, you know? And then the effect on crime is the one that's, like, really debated on whether it aided crime or, you know, made it lesser. Some believe that illegal bootlegging funded crime syndicates, which was, you know, the case with Al Capone. We saw that. But other people point out that other illegal activities, such as gambling, prostitution, arms dealing, and racketeering, would have just taken the place of bootlegging, like, if Prohibition wasn't a thing. So... what also makes this pretty debated is that there was a lack of organized police records at the time, so it's really hard to track the influx or decrease of crime at the time because we just don't have the records for it.
Yeah.
And but
it's
yeah,
like cops can kind of choose what they want to do.
Yeah.
Like, and oh, well, we're going to let you white guys off over here with a warning. All yeah, of you like, poor guys, you're going to prison.
For sure. Like, so I'm like Auntie and I'm Low, and you're coming with me. But yeah, there's still the remnants of Prohibition in the U.S. There are still a lot of dry counties across the U.S., especially in the South. Actually, there's a ton in Arkansas. There's like... Arkansas has more than any other state of just, like, dry counties where they don't sell any alcohol ever. But, I mean, still, you know, a lot of counties, including mine, don't sell alcohol on Sunday. I don't think that's national, but a lot of them do.
I grew up next to a dry county.
Really?
And that was where, like, I'm from a very small town, but that was where the main college was.
Yeah.
And I was like, what do you guys do? You can't even go out to bars or, like, anything. And it's, like, right in, like, Amish country, too.
Yeah.
So I was just, like, and I worked there while I was in high school. And they were just, like, yeah, we just go home every weekend to our parents' house.
Oh,
I was like,
God.
What is college here?
What kind of college experience is that? I remember I actually, like, on the big college tour trip that I took with my mom to, like, visit places, we, like, saw one that was, like, on my list or something that my counselor put on the list. And we're like, okay, we'll go check it out. And it was a dry college. And I remember, like, making eye contact with my mom, like, when they said that in the door. And we both were like, no. And we, like, stuck around to be polite, but, like, we were like, no, that's not gonna work out for me.
Yeah. I mean, isn't every college supposed to be a dry college? If you're underage.
If you're underage. But if you're not underage, as long as you're not living on campus.
Yeah.
Yeah, they just don't want people drinking on campus. But if you're of age drinking in your home, your college can't kick you out if you get, alcohol citation or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the prohibition.
Wow.
Pretty fascinating. Didn't know a lot of that stuff. Just knew it was like a fun speakeasy flapper time.
Yeah, I always like was confused about prohibition because I was like, that is like the one thing in history that I was taught where it was like, we made a whoopsie. Like,
yeah,
everything else, it was like, no, we needed to because the war was important because of this. And I was like, really? But I feel like we just messed up. And they were like, no, this is how it happened. Yeah. And then with Prohibition, they were just like, yeah, we just, like, wanted to try it out and it didn't really work. So, whatever.
Our bad.
But then, like, the Vietnam War, no, that was important.
Like, yeah, I know. It is crazy. I do feel like because probably the Congress was drunk throughout this time, they were like, yeah, we made a whoopsie. Yeah.
It's also like, I remember I grew up with a girl that was like very nostalgic for different eras. And she was always just like, I belonged in the 20s. The 20s were like when I should have been alive. And I was like, first of all, you're a woman. So, like, no, it would have been worse. Second of all, like, why? And she's just like, speakeasies, they were so classy. And I'm like, okay, I feel like you're romanticizing a weird time in history.
They for sure were. Like, I feel like speakeasies probably weren't that classy. There were probably people like throwing up and like
they were probably really gross, and men were probably really gross in them. And you also could have been arrested.
So, yes, like,
that sounds stressful. I don't want to be a part of that.
Yeah, but
it's like, oh, it was the Roaring Twenties, and it's like, okay, you know, they call them the Roaring Twenties. It was because we like crashed the economy like 9 years later. So like,
yeah,
ugh,
yeah. Crazy,
weird time.
Very weird time that I just like was not in tune with.
But then, like, the 30s would have been worse, obviously. And then the 40s was just nonsense. And then
the 40s is, like, an era of time that I just, like, don't think about ever.
The late 40s, like, after World War II, I have no idea what we were doing.
People were just putting women in houses, right? Like, you just had to be a housewife. There's, like, nothing else.
I mean, there was the baby boomers. Everybody was just getting pregnant.
Yeah, because they were just popping out babies.
And being conservative.
Ew.
Yeah. I don't know. Because then, like, the 50s were just, like, lame. And then the 60s were, like, crazy. Fun. And then the 70s just went off the rails.
Okay.
In my eyes. But, yeah. Hey, now it's... I like all the things on the internet about, like, 2020, where it's just like, yeah, we brought back a pandemic, threat of a world war, an impeachment.
It's the remix.
Civil rights, like warfare. And it was like, yeah, we're just compiling everything and putting it in the first 6 months of 2020.
Yeah, we are.
It's fun.
Great. Welcome to the world. Have fun.
Aren't we glad the pandemic is over? Everything is back to normal.
Yes, in my mind. Yes, indeed. So we explained it. I explained it a little bit.
And now we can go drink some whiskey.
Because we're not in Prohibition anymore.
Yes. Except they make my head hurt, so I'll opt out. but if I wanted to, I could.
Drank all my booze this weekend, so I don't have any, so I won't be either. I will be having chamomile tea. With some but honey. Still. Yeah.
All right. So, well,
splained away.
Splained that one away.